Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Although a battle may be over in a day, the conflict can often continue for generations. That's the story behind historian Ari Kelman's account of the Sand Creek Massacre. On November 29, 1864, Colonel John Shivington led elements of two Colorado volunteer regiments to a winter encampment of Cheyenne and Arapaho Indians and annihilated the camp, killing over 150, mostly the elderly, women, and children. In the days and years afterwards, it would be hailed as a great battle, the first in a number of wars against the tribes of the Great Plains and the Mountain West, though Native peoples would view it as the beginning of the last chapter of a great tragedy. But eventually, history would take a second look at this conflict and label it, properly, a massacre, one perpetrated by the government against another people. And that conflict continues to this day, even through the creation of a National Historic Site at Sand Creek in eastern Colorado. Ari Kelman is the author of A Misplaced Massacre, Struggling Over the Memory of Sand Creek. It's published by Harvard University Press. He's a professor of history at the University of California, Davis, and the author of a previous book, A River in Its City, The Nature of Landscape in New Orleans, which is prescient in its understanding of the damage of Hurricane Katrina. He's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Ari Kelman, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you. It's really nice to be here, Rich.
The story of Sand Creek has been very controversial. November 29th, 1864, Cheyenne and Arapaho are in one of their winter camps in this very desolate landscape with a little bit of cover along the Sand Creek. And these two volunteer regiments from Colorado come in and swoop in and basically massacre the occupants of the village, which were mainly women and children. It's been controversial. What interested you in the story now, 150 years later?
I was interested in, well, really a number of different elements of the story, but probably the thing that captivated me the most was, first of all, that it's a Civil War story and that we don't have a great many stories of Native people in the Civil War. I was very, very interested in the fact that these were volunteer soldiers, citizen soldiers from, as you said, two Colorado regiments. And I was quite captivated by the idea that these soldiers who had fought very honorably in many instances in a number of other Civil War battles and engagements were involved in what at the time was recognized as a massacre. And so actually, when I was an undergraduate writing my undergraduate honors thesis, I wrote an honors thesis about why citizen soldiers fought as hard as they did in the United States Civil War. As you might imagine, there was a great deal of concern among so-called regular army in the run-up to the Civil War that all of these volunteer soldiers, when they were confronted with the fighting, would just turn tail and run. But in the event, they didn't, and they had remarkably high rates of casualties and were nevertheless very, very courageous under fire. And so I was interested, this is a long time ago now, I'm not going to date myself, but it was a couple decades ago, I was interested in why these soldiers had fought as hard as they had with so little training. And in the course of doing research for that project, I stumbled across a letter from an Indiana farm boy who was in, I forget which regiment, but it was one of the regiments in the so-called Iron Brigade, which was the brigade of soldiers that had the highest rate of casualties in the Union Army.
Saved Gettysburg, yes.
That's exactly right. Yeah. And this young man was writing a letter home, and it was in 1865, and he talked about the shame of Shivington's massacre. And I had no idea what he was talking about, but he was quite upset about this, and he was writing to his mother or sister, but he was writing a letter home, and I looked at this letter and went to my advisor and said, what the heck is Shivington's massacre? And my advisor said, I have absolutely no idea. Mm. And so I went to several other people and finally ran down that, oh, this was Sand Creek that this guy was talking about. So I began to wonder why this, again, Indiana farm boy in the most decorated, most prestigious unit in the Union Army, why he was so upset about something that happened way out on the frontier. Why would that have mattered to him? But it obviously did a great deal because it cast his own service, he believed, in a very different light. And so I remained interested in Sand Creek. And then when my family and I lived out in Colorado, it happened to be a very, very opportune moment for me to look into it. Then the second reason that I became very interested in the subject was that while we were in Colorado, the National Park Service decided to create a Sand Creek Massacre National Historic Site. And the name is very important, because they were not interested in sort of any half measures. The rhetoric wasn't equivocal at all. It was going to be called the massacre site. And I became quite interested in the process of creating a national historic site to commemorate an episode of this sort of extraordinary violence and really malfeasance on the part of federal troops. And so I began looking into it, and it turned into a pretty extraordinary story along the way, with, you know, casino corporations hopping in to buy up land and a big fight over where the site actually was, and on and on and on. And it turned into a good project for me.
What's interesting, and this goes for our own National Historic Site out in western Oklahoma, what was known as the Battle of the Ouachita, at one point.
Sure. Yep.
Sand Creek was also known as the Battle of Sand Creek.
That's right.
And in both of those cases, it wasn't any sort of a battle, more than it was a ambush and a massacre.
Right.
Basically running through the village, killing all the occupants, which mainly were women and children in both cases.
That's right. So in the case of Sand Creek, in the summer and fall of 1864, there are a number of different very ugly engagements between Native peoples on the plains to the east of Denver and settlers who are living on those plains. And the violence escalates and escalates. And in the summer of 1864, Colorado's territorial governor, John Evans, issues first one and then a second proclamation asking the so-called friendly Indians on the plains to the east of Denver to come into forts, to come into military installations, and effectively to surrender. And then late in the summer, he issues a second proclamation in which he asks the people of Colorado to participate in hunting down hostile Indians in Colorado.
So was it a matter of, if you're friendly to us, come into the forts, and if you don't come into the forts, we're going to assume you're hostile?
That was effectively what Evans had in mind. And as he was doing that, it really is important to understand that this is playing out against the backdrop of the United States Civil War. And so Evans is sending a series of dispatches back to Washington, D.C., in which he's suggesting to military authorities that there's a huge confederation of tribes on the plains to the east of Denver that are allied with the Confederacy, or that may become allied with the Confederacy. And he actually points to Indian territory, to what now is Oklahoma, and says, look at the example of the Cherokees, who had already forged an alliance with the Confederacy. And Evans, the upshot of all of this is that he wants federal funds to raise a regiment to fight Indians in Colorado territory. And in September of 1864, a number of peace chiefs come into Denver, and they want a meeting with Evans. And the leading member of this delegation is Black Kettle, Chief Black Kettle, who actually ends up being killed at the Ouachita.
At Ouachita, yeah.
So Black Kettle comes into Denver with a number of other peace chiefs, and they sit down with John Evans, and Evans says, things have been so bad for so many months now that it's out of my hands. You need to deal with military authorities in the territory. And Evans directs them to have a discussion with John Shivington, who's a colonel, and who's been put in charge of this new regiment of Indian fighters. And they talk to Shivington, Black Kettle and others talk to Shivington, and Shivington says to them that if they go into Fort Lyon, which is a fort in southeastern Colorado, and they present themselves, that they'll be protected, that they'll be safe. And so these chiefs go back down to Fort Lyon, and the commander of the fort tells them to go and camp on Sand Creek. He says, if you just go out to Sand Creek, just wait there. If anything comes up, he says to them, I'll get word to you. But otherwise, we'll just assume that everything's okay. And so these chiefs bring their followers. It's about 1,000 people total. It's a very, very large encampment, about 100 lodges or so. And they go out to Sand Creek. And then in November, Shivington brings approximately 700 cavalrymen from the 1st and the 3rd Colorado Regiment. And they slaughter maybe 150 to 175 people in that camp, the overwhelming majority of whom are women or children or very elderly. And in the aftermath of that bloodshed, Shivington spends a great deal of his time on what we today would call spin, right? He engages in a big PR campaign and is quite successful in Colorado. Coloradans call this the Battle of Sand Creek. They view...
As securing the eastern frontier of Colorado.
That's exactly right. They view this as an absolutely critical milestone on the road to bringing civilization to the plains and to the Mountain West. And also at the time as having been a glorious Civil War battle. they view this as having been a critical part of winning the Civil War in the West, because again, Evans and others have been saying that these tribes are, that they've all been negotiating with the Confederacy. And so this is part of putting down the rebellion, Shivington and others claim. And the only reason that that doesn't end up becoming the official story is that there are a couple of Shivington subordinates who are really horrified by what happened at Sand Creek.
And apparently that story got out because it gets all the way back to the Army of the Potomac in the East.
That's exactly right. And those Shivington subordinates, a man named Joe Kramer and a man named Silas Sewell, are quite well connected, as it turns out. And they write letters to a number of generals and other very, very well connected people in Washington, D.C. And ultimately what ends up happening is that there are three federal inquiries into Sand Creek. And each of those inquiries determined that Sand Creek was, in fact, a massacre, that it was not a battle, that this was a bad act. And all three of them are quite intent on containing the blame. What they want to do is say that this was really John Shivington's doing, that maybe Governor John Evans was implicated in this, but it's really Shivington and the men who were under him who are responsible for this. What they want to try and suggest is that this in no way reflects the goals of the federal government, and nor should it be construed as having been part of the Civil War, which, again, was a glorious and great fight to save the Union. But Shivington and his surviving men aren't content with this because it's their reputations that are on the line, and they don't want to be called perpetrators of a massacre or murderers. So they continue in Colorado with the same kind of a PR campaign, and again, they're quite successful. In 1909, the state of Colorado, unveils a Civil War memorial on the state capitol steps, an absolutely beautiful memorial.
Basically writing their own history.
That's exactly
which
right.
Happened throughout the Civil War and throughout the Indian Wars
as
well.
That's right. And on the base of that statue, there's a list of all the Civil War battles, so-called, and engagements in which Coloradans had fought, and Sand Creek is listed among them. Not as a massacre, but again, as this is an honor roll. And it's right there. And so that remains the sort of official memory in Colorado through the 1950s. There are a couple of additional...
Probably in the 60s. I mean, it probably starts getting reexamined in the 60s and 70s.
That's exactly right.
I remember when I was a kid, Sand Creek was considered a battle.
Absolutely.
The Battle of the Ouachita. Wounded Knee, for example. I mean, you were talking earlier about how this wasn't the stated policy of U.S. military, but... unfortunately, this pattern was repeated time and time again, even the Battle of Little Bighorn.
Custer.
It was basically Custer going through the village first until he realized, wow, there's a lot more than I thought.
Well, yeah, Custer...
I mean, that was sort of the policy, to destroy the villages and the noncombatants.
That's right. Well, I mean, the way that I tend to think about it is that in the 1860 election, which we now look back on as having been a referendum on slavery... the Lincoln campaign runs on the Republican policy of not allowing slavery to spread into the American West, into land that had been acquired as a result of the United States-Mexican War. And the Democratic Party splits in the 1860 election. But on the one hand, you've got popular sovereignty, and on the other hand, you've got John Breckinridge, who's just going to push slavery wholesale into the West. So the 1860 election, again, in American memory, tends to be an election that was a referendum on the expansion of slavery, but it was also at the time very much a referendum on two different visions of empire. A Republican Party vision of empire that was going to create a white man's republic in the West that was going to be built atop free soil, and a Democratic Party vision of empire that also was interested in expanding into the West, but bringing slavery along with that expansion. Lincoln obviously wins. And then during the Civil War, the Republican Party sets about creating all of the different elements that they need to realize this vision of empire.
So everything from land-grant colleges to the Transcontinental Railroad.
That's exactly right. The Pacific Railroad Act, the land-grant colleges, the Homestead Act, the Department of Agriculture, and on and on and on. But along with all of those elements of...
which have their noble aspects, but for Native peoples, that was a death warrant.
That's absolutely
to their
right.
Traditional way of life.
Right. But in addition to all of those elements of the federal government's civil branch, there's also the military wing of this vision of empire. And what happens during the Civil War, as you've just suggested a moment ago, is that a number of different extraordinarily able officers become very, very effective. They learn how to implement strategy and tactics. And then when the war is over, or in the case of Sand Creek, before the war is over, they bring those insights and they bring their battle-hardened troops with them into the West, and they fight the Indian Wars, which many people would argue begin at Sand Creek and then don't end, as you said a moment ago, until Wounded Knee. And so you see a series of these episodes from Sand Creek to the Washita throughout the so-called Great Sioux War, ultimately ending up at Wounded Knee. And looking back, it certainly does appear that this is the goal of federal policy, is to remove people peacefully if possible, to remove Native peoples peacefully if possible. But if not, then to kill them.
Well, let's fast forward a little bit. In the 70s, we do have this reassessment of what a lot of these Indian battles mean. Wasn't the Battle of the Little Bighorn at one point called Custer's Battle?
Custer Massacre. Yeah. Custer Massacre.
Yeah, Custer
because,
Massacre.
Because Custer had been massacred by the Lakotas and others, yeah.
Yeah, and all of a sudden there's this reassessment, and now the National Park Service is involved, and they're having to tread this still, even 130, 120 years later, a highly politically charged situation in creating something like a Sand Creek Massacre National Historic Site. You could probably create a Sand Creek National Historic Site.
That's right.
Add the word massacre, it becomes politically loaded, and that fire charge of politicism is still involved years later.
Absolutely. So the modern story of trying to memorialize Sand Creek really begins in the 1990s. When a group of Coloradans working with descendants of the victims and survivors of Sand Creek, so these are Northern Cheyennes, Northern Arapahos, Southern Cheyennes, and Southern Arapahos, this group of people get together because some, call them fortune hunters, Western history buffs, go down to what people think is the traditional site of the Sand Creek Massacre, and they begin prospecting for arrowheads and for regimental pins and for minne balls and all of the sort of artifacts that one typically finds at the sites of these Indian massacres and also at Civil War battlefields. And these two men look around the site and they don't find anything at all. They spend an entire day with metal detectors, and these are pretty seasoned prospectors, and they don't find a single thing. And they come back to Denver and they approach the chief historian of the Colorado Historical Society, a man named David Hollis. And they say to David Hollis, we were down at Sand Creek and it was clean. The ground was sterile. There's nothing there at all. And Hollis says, well, that can't be. And they say, trust us. And Hollis says, I'm going to go down there. And so he does. And he goes down and he pokes around and he spends a great deal of time and he doesn't find anything at all. And he says, well, this is really very, very strange. And at the time, he says, for Western historians, this is like losing the Gettysburg battlefield. It's like losing something that is that central to the history of the region. And so he gets funding and goes out in the field and begins poking around and looking for the massacre site. As that's going on, the man who owns the ranch on which people traditionally had believed that the massacre had taken place for a host of reasons of his own decides that he wants to sell his land. He wants to leave eastern Colorado. He's been working that land for about a half a century, and he's ready to move on. And he approaches Senator Ben Nighthorse Campbell, who at that time is the only Native American in the United States Senate. And he's also a member of the Cheyenne Council of 44 chiefs. And he approaches Senator Campbell and says, I'd like to sell my land. And Senator Campbell says, fantastic. The senator had his eye on this land for a very long time and had been quite interested in creating a historic site there to be called whatever it would be called. That wasn't so much his concern. He just wanted to protect that land. And so Senator Campbell goes to the Park Service and says to regional director of the National Park Service, let's create a historic site here. The director of the Park Service says, absolutely, that's a wonderful idea. We don't have enough sites devoted to Native peoples and Native history. This would be a great thing for us to do. And the legislation goes through. And then David Hollis, the chief of the Colorado Historical Society, says, this is a terrific idea. There's just one problem. We have no idea where it is. And Senator Campbell says, you're kidding. And the National Park Service says, oh, because the Park Service can't create a historic site wherever it wants. They can't do this willy-nilly, right?
They have to have the site.
They actually have to have the proper site. Otherwise, they embarrass themselves, and it does violence to the past. And so The Park Service then launches an 18-month multi-tiered search where they send historians into the archives, they send archaeologists into the field, they send people to do remote sensing to try and do subsurface investigations without stirring the earth. They involve the descendants themselves, and they do a number of ethnographies, oral histories. And over the course of this 18 months, a number of things become clear. And probably the most important of those is that Sand Creek was a massacre. They find all sorts of what the Park Service believes is incontrovertible evidence suggesting that the native peoples in that camp didn't fight back in any sort of a way that would suggest that this could be called a battle. And at the end of that time, the Park Service discovers a plume of artifacts approximately a mile upstream from what people had traditionally believed was the site of the massacre. And where, by the way, there's a historic marker that says Sand Creek Battleground at that traditional location. But the Park Service finds this plume of artifacts, hundreds and hundreds of period-correct artifacts, which they then cross-reference with other sites of Indian massacres from the period. And it's quite clear to the Park Service that they've found the site. And they're thrilled about this. And they then present their findings to the Sand Creek descendants, who say no. They say that may be where part of this happened, but that is not the Sand Creek massacre site. And most importantly, they say that is not where Black Kettle camped. And the reason for this is that they, for over a century, have been going to that spot. That's the traditional site, they call it. And they've based their decision to go to that traditional site on the writings of a man named George Bent, who's a Southern Cheyenne and the son of William Bent.
Bent's Fort.
Bent's Fort and a Borderlands trade tycoon and his Cheyenne wife, Owl Woman. And George Bent, at the beginning of the 20th century, responded to the effort in Colorado to try to continue to cast Sand Creek as a battle rather than a massacre, and particularly as a Civil War battle, by writing a number of articles and also producing a number of maps. And the Sand Creek descendants have read all of this material, and they've looked at these maps, and they say, well, we never lost Sand Creek. You know, we know that you needed to pinpoint the site of the massacre for this historic site. We were okay with that, but we're not okay with the federal government telling us our own history, because we never lost this place. How dare you tell us where this horrible event, which is really a hinge event in tribal history, where this happened? And so they produce their own map, and it turns into quite a very difficult controversy for the Park Service.
How was it resolved?
It's resolved because the Park Service ultimately comes up with a very, very elegant compromise. They create a National Historic Site that's big enough to include all of these different stories. Because they say, quite rightly, that the American people are diverse. This is a pluralistic society, and we can't expect everyone to have exactly the same perception of American history. And so they say, we're going to create a site that's big enough that we'll be able to fit those interpretations, and if any others come up, we can put them in there as well. And that's what they do. And so they're able in 2007 to open this site, and they can call it the Sand Creek Massacre National Historic Site because they've got all sorts of forensic evidence suggesting that that's the appropriate name. The descendants are very pleased by that nomenclature. They don't want this to be called the Sand Creek Battleground. In fact, they wouldn't have participated in this process had it been. And the site opens.
Was there any opposition still to putting the word massacre into the site?
Of course. So at the site's opening ceremony in 2007, which is a wonderful event, by the way, and the site itself is extraordinary. And so if your listeners have an opportunity to get out there to eastern Colorado, it's in the middle of nowhere, but it's worth the trip because it's a beautiful, beautiful spot. It's haunting. It's very somber, but it's quite lovely. At the opening ceremony in 2007, there are at these sorts of events, there's sort of a litany of speakers. And for the first 2+ hours, the speakers are all expressing optimism about what this site can mean. And what they talk about again and again and again is healing. They say that this sort of a site, like the Murrah Building in Oklahoma City or the 9/11 Memorial, that this will be a site of healing. It'll be an opportunity for people to gather together, to remember the past together, and to find some comfort in that experience. And so it's very, very optimistic for the first part of this. And then a number of people stand up. Many of them are tribal activists. One is Eastern Colorado's congressional representative at the time. And that's Marilyn Musgrave. And Marilyn Musgrave, who's no longer in the United States Congress, but she talks about political correctness. She talks about revisionism and the way, and she's obviously extremely discomfited by this name. Now, she has good reason for that. Her constituents in Eastern Colorado, including in the surrounding communities, are very, very uncomfortable about calling this the Sand Creek Massacre because they don't want the National Park Service. They don't want the federal government because the federal government's not very popular on the plains of Eastern Colorado. I know that's a big surprise. these people don't want the federal government, but they also don't want the people of Denver. They don't want the Colorado Historical Society coming down and telling them that they've got a massacre site in their backyard. Many of these people are descended from soldiers who'd fought in Sand Creek, and even those who aren't have, as you said, in your own childhood, they've grown up hearing about the Sand Creek Battleground. This is a place that local people had gone for picnics on Sunday after church. There had been some baptisms in the creek through the years. It's a very, very popular spot, and they don't want it renamed on their watch. So they're very, very unhappy about this. And then there are a number of national heritage organizations, including probably most important among them was the Order of the Indian Wars, which is a group of professional historians and also buffs, amateur historians, who study the Indian Wars. They're very, very interested. They do very, very good work. And they, too, the leaders of that organization are extremely put off at the idea that this is going to be called the Sand Creek Massacre National Historic Site, because they see this as political correctness run amok, as revisionism. And so they fight very, very hard. But in the end, the site does open, and it opens under that name.
Has this calmed down now? Is this sort of settled, or is this still a point of debate among historians and people who have some interest in this site?
No, it's still a history front in a broader culture war, right? And so right now the Colorado Historical Society, which I believe has been renamed History Colorado, they've got a Sand Creek exhibit, which has been incredibly controversial now for many, many years, and they've just been forced to shut that exhibit down. The Sand Creek descendants were not pleased with the content of that exhibit, and they finally have succeeded in closing that exhibit. And at the site, there are still occasionally people who will come and who will say how very disappointed they are in this name. But in the main, people they get about 10,000 to 15,000 visitors a year. They have since 2007, which is a pretty big number. Again, this is way off the beaten path. It's
nowhere.
It's 100 miles from nowhere.
Yeah, that's right.
And for the most part, people are curious. They get a lot of surprise. Sand Creek Massacre National Historic Site, and then the way that the story is recounted there, it's quite balanced. But nevertheless, it is a story of a massacre, and so a number of people find it surprising that the federal government is memorializing the actions of the United States Army and labeling those actions a massacre. Nevertheless, it's the people who run the site have been very, very surprised at the positive reception that's received.
All right. Well, Ari Kelman, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Ari Kelman is our guest today, professor of history at the University of California, Davis, and the author of A Misplaced Massacre, Struggling Over the Memory of Sand Creek, published by Harvard University Press. He's also the author of a forthcoming graphic book on the history of the Civil War, titled Battle Lines. That's due out next year. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.